Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King.
Today is November the 20th, 2019.
Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m., Eastern Time, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet and PCRadioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org.
In the news, rating cities with the fastest and slowest internet speeds. You can now buy pretend food for the Sony robot dog. Hulu live TV plan just got a lot more expensive. FTC fines AT&T $60 million for throttling unlimited data. And AT&T loses nearly 1 million TV customers after raising DirecTV prices. Feature segments, Benjamin Rockwell, his IT Pro series covering employer monitoring of employees. From the Tech Corner, G Suite as an alternative to Microsoft Office, and will 2020 be the year of the Linux desktop? And from Marty Winston, on his technology perspectives, using the wrong approach to clear snow on your driveway can mean nasty repair costs.
Rating cities with the fastest and slowest internet speeds. How does your internet speed compare with others? HighSpeedInternet.com has created a report to share the cities with the fastest and slowest internet speeds. Which cities are still lagging behind with slower speeds? At HighSpeedInternet.com, they completed just past 2 million speed tests. The data analyst at HighSpeedInternet.com looked at the data and took the average of every city in the United States, then ranked them from fastest to slowest. You can read the full report at HighSpeedInternet.com. The cities with the fastest internet. You won't believe this. Bayside, New York, 100.8 megabits per second. Longmont, Colorado, 100.5 megabits per second. Somerset, New Jersey, 97.6 megabits per second. Sterling, Virginia, 96.9 megabits per second. And Elmhurst, New York, 95.9 megabits per second. The cities with the slowest internet: Silver, North Carolina, 6.5 megabits per second, but that's a population of 2,644. That's understandable. Stowe, Vermont, 6.7 megabits per second, population of 4,423. Española, New Mexico, 7.7 megabits per second, a population of just over 10,000. Oneonta, Alabama, 7.7 megabits per second with a population of 6,567 people. And Ville Platte, Louisiana, 8 megabits per second with a population of 7,432. Nationwide, the average internet speed was 50.2 megabits per second. The number of cities ranked, 2,359. And, as I said before, the city with the fastest average internet speed, Bayside, New York, 100.8, and city with the slowest average internet speed, Silver, North Carolina, 6.5. In New York City, there are multiple franchise vendors. DeWitt, which is the Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications, manages telecommunications franchises for New York City, including those for cable television. Three companies currently have cable television franchises with the city: Altice USA, Spectrum, and Verizon. A fourth company, RCN, holds an open video system contract. The cable television franchise contracts and the OVS contract requires the companies to pay a 5% commission to the city on revenues derived from video services. The contracts also require significant levels of customer service. In fiscal year 2018, the city received approximately $127 million in franchise fees. Verizon has the fastest upload and download speeds in New York City, but Fios has only wired selective neighborhoods. This would account for why Bayside and Elmhurst in Queens have the highest internet speeds and not the other neighborhoods in the city. And, of course, the natural question is, why hasn't Verizon installed Fios throughout the city? Compared to the rest of the country, or even just the rest of the state, New York City is extremely connected. Over 99% of the city's residents have access to internet speeds higher than the 58.19% average nationwide. New Yorkers in all five boroughs can get access to top-end broadband providers and fast internet speeds. But exactly which internet service providers offer service in your area depends on, of course, your neighborhood. So why isn't Verizon more widely installed in New York City? Verizon blames landlords and New York City officials. Verizon has blamed landlords for not providing access to buildings. But some building owners have said they sought fiber installations, but Verizon didn't follow through. City officials allege that Verizon has demanded bulk agreements or exclusive agreements for multi-unit residential buildings that would limit or eliminate competition from other providers, even though the FCC bans exclusive video service deals in multiple dwelling units. Verizon also blames the city for not helping the company gain access to buildings. The city's previous findings verified that Verizon had met requirements to pass certain percentages of buildings in the city by date specified in the agreement. This allows Verizon to reduce the amount of its performance bond. However, the city never agreed with Verizon that it had passed 100% of buildings. So when a wire is run past through a block of homes, they count as premises that cannot be connected without further installation of substantial cable plant, such as feeder and distribution cables, to reach the area which a potential new subscriber is located. In other words, Verizon is seeking to maximize their return on wiring installations. Wiring a building without a total commitment of subscribers may not be profitable and or operate at a loss. Fios was granted franchise agreements after Time Warner had started cabling New York City. Time Warner services now Charter Spectrum, and many subscribers are locked into Spectrum subscriptions with different expiration dates. And therefore, that's the conundrum why we are not getting Fios when you want it, even though they want to provide it.
Have you ever had a pet dog? And, well, today you don't think you could care for one? You can now buy a Sony robot dog, and it costs slightly under $3,000. And if you want more realism with it, you can now buy pretend food for your $2,900 Sony robot dog. There's no denying the appeal of a robot dog. You get the companionship, the fun of playtime, and pre-programmed loyalty without all that mess or expenses of feeding and maintenance and, of course, walking the dog. Unless you really want to feed your Aibo, which is what they call the Sony robot dog, in which case, Sony will happily sell you, get this, make-believe virtual meals and treats that unlock fun tricks that your $2,900, well, robotic dog can perform. This was first released back in 1999. Sony's robotic dog, Aibo, that was so lifelike and animated that, well, for those not keeping score at home back in 2017, Sony revived its robotic dog, Aibo, with a new version featuring impressive hardware upgrades, but I would feel that these upgrades are questionable features and functionality. It also came back from the dead with a $2,900 price tag, plus the cost of a cloud subscription service the first 3 years, which are included. If you wanted to unlock the more advanced features of the robotic dog, you just paid a small fortune for, well, it can be done. Since Aibo's release, Sony has been pushing out software updates that add new features, like turning the robot into a home security sentry. The latest update, version 2.50, which is now available, expands Aibo's customization with a new web-based API and development program allowing the robot to be programmed to perform custom tasks and actions, even for amateur coders who have access to the easier Aibo Visual Programming Interface. The new feature that will appeal to most owners, however, is Aibo Food, which allows the robot to be virtually fed using augmented reality through the Aibo smartphone app. Meals can be purchased using coins which are awarded to users through random actions like repeatedly using the Aibo app or during special events. But once users run out of coins, which is bound to happen at some later time, as they try out the new Aibo food feature, they can either wait for more Sony handouts or purchase additional coins for, of course, a fee. Sony points out that Aibo's performance and features aren't dependent on whether the dog is regularly fed. It is, after all, just a robot. So hopefully the company won't change its mind down the line, making your pup act sluggish and distracted when you're not forking out to buy pretend food. On top of buying foods and treats using coins, the new Aibo food feature also works with a new food bowl accessory, which isn't available for sale yet, which the app presumably recognizes and tracks for the full augmented reality experience. But users can also skip the bowl and feed their Aibo by hand like some kind of a techno-future heathen. Of course, other complications arrive once you start feeding an animal, and the new software update also allows users to finally potty train their Aibo using a new snapping feature so the robot doesn't pretend defecating all over your house. This appears to be a free feature until Sony realizes it can sell owners virtual poop too. Oh boy. For those who have been cord cutting, they've been using live streaming services such as Hulu, Disney Plus, Netflix, and others. Well, if you like your Hulu Plus live TV subscription, I got some bad news for you. The company announced last week that its Very Good Hulu Plus live TV plan, which includes ad-supported Hulu Plus access to live and on-demand TV channels, is hiking the price from $45 a month to $55 a month beginning December the 18th. Considering this amounts to an additional $120 per year you're paying for the service, on top of whatever other pricey subscriptions you're also paying for, well, such as Netflix, an extra $10 per month is nothing to sneeze at. When Hulu commented about the changes, the blog didn't offer much insight as why Hulu landed on such exact number other than to state that the new monthly subscription cost better reflects the substantial value of Hulu Plus Live TV and allows them to continue offering all of the popular live news, sports, and entertainment programming included in the plan. To its benefit, Hulu seems to realize that this is not especially great news for users of the service, and note that switching between the plans as needed is one way to get around having to shell out the extra $120 a year. Disney made a lot of promises for its streaming service. Price changes are never easy to stomach, and we all know that many people don't watch live television year-round. So we've made it easy for Hulu subscribers to switch back and forth between our plans to best suit your needs. The company said if you love college football, choose Hulu Plus Live TV during the season, then switch to one of Hulu's less expensive on-demand plans when it's over. If you enjoy most of your TV on-demand but really want to watch live election news, just switch to Hulu Plus Live TV for a few months. The problem with this, however, is that most people don't tend to their various potentially many services like house plans, and it could be easy to forget to cancel a subscription when you meant to. This seems like less of a solution than a gain in the, well, you know where. Although Hulu admittedly made it less of a pain in the you know where than it could be. According to an email sent to a Hulu Plus Live TV customer, it stated that folks will start seeing this price change reflected in their first billing cycle after the December 18th adjustment date. Enjoy your last month of discount to Hulu Live TV while it lasts. That's one of the problems with cord cutting. Yes, you get your price down, but the internet price goes up, and now we find that some of these streaming services are jacking up their rates. AT&T pays millions to settle FTC claims of unlimited data had limits. AT&T, the largest U.S. mobile phone company, agreed to pay $60 million to settle Federal Trade Commission's claims that it misled millions of smartphone customers with offers of unlimited data plans that carried poorly disclosed risk. The company failed to adequately warn subscribers that it would throttle their data speeds, rendering many commonly used apps such as internet browsing and video streaming unusable if their data usage in a particular billing cycle topped threshold levels, the agency said in a 2014 complaint. AT&T promised unlimited data without qualification, well, really with qualification, and failed to deliver on that promise, said director of the Consumer Protection Division. While it seems obvious, it bears repeating that internet providers must tell people about any restrictions on the speed or amount of data promise. AT&T didn't immediately respond to a message seeking comment. The Dallas-based company began curbing data speeds on unlimited plans in 2011 after customers used as little as 2 gigabytes in a billing period. The commission said the slowdown affected more than 3.5 million subscribers as of October 2014. The telecom giant, which has since expanded into television, movies, and video streaming with the purchase of Time Warner, originally argued that the FTC lacked jurisdiction but was overruled by the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals last year. Under the settlement, AT&T is barred from making any claims that its data service is unlimited without prominently disclosing significant restrictions on speeds or amounts. The money it's paying will be deposited into a fund, providing partial refunds to current and former customers who signed up for unlimited plans before 2011 and had their data transmission speeds reduced. The company could have upheld its obligations to its customers by making the right infrastructure investment. It certainly had the money to do so, said in a statement on Tuesday by the FTC. In 2012, as the company boasted to investors that customers were fleeing its unlimited plan for tiered plans, it spent more on share buybacks than it invested in its wireless network. AT&T lost a huge number of cable subscribers this past quarter. With so much competition in the cable TV arena, AT&T isn't doing so great. The company, which owns both DirecTV and U-verse, recently revealed that it has lost a large number of cable and satellite subscribers in its third quarter alone. This raises concerns for what the loss of customers might mean for the future of AT&T and other players within the cable and TV industry. AT&T, which acquired Time Warner in 2018, has owned DirecTV since 2014, reported a loss of 1.16 million TV subscribers in its third quarter. The company's app, AT&T Now, reportedly lost an estimated 195,000 subscribers. In its second quarter earnings report, the company reported an estimated 778,000 loss in DirecTV satellite and U-verse customers combined. It looks like the company needs a major boost if it's to stop hemorrhaging subscribers. Now, part of the third quarter's heavy losses might be due to CBS cutting its ties with AT&T's DirecTV earlier this year. AT&T CEO was hopeful that the company's fourth quarter earnings would bounce back, especially now that Joker has surpassed $900 million at the global box office for Warner Brothers and continues to make waves. Still, the CBS blackout didn't help, and many TV subscribers, angry with the loss of access, may have decided to sever their own deals with AT&T after that. The massive loss of AT&T television subscribers plays a major factor in the company's rising debt, which currently sits at $170 billion. Even Warner Media revenue dropped around 4.4% in the third quarter, which only added to the company's financial losses. Right now, AT&T is sitting on a goldmine of beloved media and has time to bounce back from its losses, especially since the company has committed to holding off on any expansion and acquisitions through 2022 and is selling off $5 to $10 billion in non-strategic assets to help pay off its debt. Since AT&T is set to launch its own streaming service with HBO Max, it's already lagging behind Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus, both of which are set to launch Later, AT&T's dwindling subscriber numbers probably won't help boost its streaming service launch, which is set to occur in the spring of 2020. HBO Max released some of its offering to fans last week, including a proposed Green Lantern series. HBO Max has already announced that it will exclusively be streaming Friends, the immensely popular NBC sitcom which is set to be leaving Netflix in January 2020. In addition to that, the new streaming service will also include The Big Bang Theory, the long-running comedy that CBS no longer has the rights to air on its network. The streaming service will also include a mixture of HBO and WarnerMedia-owned series like Game of Thrones and Doom Patrol, which has been renewed for Season 2, but previously aired on the DC Comics streaming service DC Universe. So it seems that HBO Max is at least trying to lure comic book fans, and with the addition of DC Strange Adventure series, they might have that audience secured. However, with AT&T bleeding subscribers, would anyone be interested in HBO Max when it launches in the spring? It depends on the pricing deal, currently at $14.99. And with the competition, with prices lower than the streaming services, I think they're going to have to bring that price down. How many viewers are interested in the shows and movies it has to offer? That remains to be seen, with customers reportedly claiming to want Disney Plus more than any other upcoming streaming service, though AT&T has their work cut out for them. The competition among streaming services is only going to be increased, and that will hold the pressure down. And as it dwindles down to a few major ones, they will be raising their prices. And if you're interested in streaming services to cut down on your cable bill, just remember, you still need internet service. Benjamin Rockwell is IT Pro Series covering employer monitoring of employees.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time to get down to business. This is where I give you some of my experience of being an IT professional for decades. Sometimes the information is helpful to employers. Sometimes it's helpful to the employees. Sometimes we're just unpacking what you might have heard about or you might be thinking about. In this case, it's a little bit of everything. In this case, I'm going to talk to you today about employee monitoring. Now, there's a number of different things in regards to employee monitoring. There's a number of different directions we can go in. I'm going to give you some of my experience with just one particular employer. And we're going to deal with, we're going to do this as anonymously as I can. Mr. S, being the boss, he's the owner of the company, and M. M is one of the employees. J is another one of the employees. We're not going to go through anything beyond this, just Mr. S, M, and J. So, Mr. S, I worked for him for a while, and one of the things that he asked of me at one point was, we've got this particular employee, M. M is, well, he's getting into trouble on the internet. He's doing a number of different things that, well, it's quite obvious he's utilizing company time in an improper manner. As a matter of fact, he's doing things in an improper manner in front of some of the ladies. Nothing that's like arrestable, but you know, it's detestable. So let's see what we can do in regards to solving the situation. So yes, I moved forward and I started to monitor him. And it was quite obvious he was going into places on the internet that you should not be going to at work. Well, you shouldn't be going to them at all, but that's another story altogether. So we locked him down. And I continued to monitor him, and we found out he was going to places that were almost detestable. So we locked him down again, and he was going to places that were time wasters. So we locked him down again. We actually got to the point where we locked him down so far. We actually turned the paradigm around. We think of employee web filtering as we lock them out of different places where they can go on the internet by utilizing these massive filters. Are they going to this particular type of website? Let's lock out all of those types of websites. Are they going to these? We'll lock those out. Instead, what we did with M was we whitelisted what he could do. So the blacklist, that's controlling it, that's saying you can't go here, you can't go here, you can't go here. Whitelist says you can go here, you can go here, you can go here. We blacklisted him to the entire internet and whitelisted him to the few places he could go. That was time consuming. That was very, very time consuming. I would say that I expended, over the course of a long time, 5% of my energies or more, and a lot of money for the company by purchasing these extra filters and so forth, to control this one rogue employee who has written up a number of times and he was counseled a number of times and, oh yeah, various other things. So leaving that aside, yes, I monitored that. But I also monitored another employee also as part of the direction of let's monitor all of the employees. And that's where we really started to waste a lot of time because, well, we monitored M and we didn't really do a whole lot other than, well, you shouldn't do that. No, well, you shouldn't do that. No, you shouldn't go there. You shouldn't. We spent a lot of time doing that. But we also spent a lot of time doing that with J. And it was the same kind of thing, except he wasn't necessarily going to any place detestable, any place that he shouldn't be going. Well, I mean, you shouldn't be doing it at work. You shouldn't be going to the sports websites. We'll just, you know, checking on, you know, the latest baseball scores for an hour. Yeah, you know, that's really not all that productive. Did we do anything? No, we didn't. And that's just part of life. Sometimes we wind up on these fruitless chases to find out information in IT, but everywhere in business. And we don't get anywhere and we feel rather less than valued because we're spinning our wheels. That's okay. What it really led me to understand, however, over the course of the time that I was with that company and working with Mr. S, that all of the different things I was doing in regards to employee monitoring amounted to not one whit of value. Sure, Mr. S knew who was goofing off. Mr. S knew all of the different problems that were going on, and yet he did nothing about them. He did absolutely nothing. So, sure, we can monitor. We can do a number of different things. But unless we're willing to take action, nothing's going to come of it. Sure, yeah, your boss can monitor all kinds of different things. And maybe they do. And maybe they do take action. Maybe they will come along and say, you're really doing the wrong thing on the internet. And maybe some of these things will be automated. They will lock you out of different areas. But a lot of people are scared that, yeah, the big, huge boss, he's spending hours on end looking at exactly what you're doing and what they're doing and all of that. And the reality is we need to relax. What we really need to do beyond relaxing and chilling out is realize that, yes, if we're working at a company, we're there to work. We should be putting in an honest day's work. And that's my biggest wish for you. Remember that you should be returning value to your company, to your employer, and to your job. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The competition for Microsoft Office is Google G Suite. G Suite is a set of cloud computing, productivity, and collaboration tools. Software and products developed by Google first launched on August 2006 as Google Apps. G Suite is comprised of Gmail, Hangouts, Calendar and Currents for communication, Drive for storage, Docs, Sheets, Slides, Keep, Forms, and Sites for productivity and collaboration, and depending on the plan, an administrative panel and vault for managing users and services. It also includes the digital interactive whiteboard Jamboard and the app development platform AppMaker. While these services are free to use for consumers, G Suite adds enterprise features such as custom email addresses using your domain site, option for unlimited cloud storage depending on plan and number of members, additional administrative tools and advanced settings, as well as 24/7 phone and email support. Data and information is saved and then synchronized to other data centers for backup purposes. Unlike the free consumer-facing services, G Suite users do not see advertisements while using the services, and information and data in G Suite accounts do not get used for advertisement purposes. Furthermore, G Suite administrators can fine-tune security and privacy settings. As of January 2017, G Suite had 4 million paying businesses and 70 million G Suite for education users. The standard version of Microsoft Office comprises of three core apps: Word, Excel, PowerPoint, plus you get Outlook and Publisher. The competition for the standard Microsoft Office is Google Docs, Sheets, and Slides. Google Docs, Google Sheets, and Google Slides are respectively a word processor, a spreadsheet, and a presentation program. The three programs originate from company acquisitions in 2006 and are today integrated into Google Drive. They all serve as collaborative software that allow users to view and edit documents, spreadsheets, and presentations together in real time through a web browser or mobile device. Changes are saved automatically with a revision history keeping track of changes. It wasn't until 2010 that Microsoft finally launched Word Online as part of its Office 365 package. In June 2014, Google introduced Office support in Google Docs, Sheets, and Slides without the need for file conversion. As part of G Suite, Google Docs and Slides come with additional features designed for business use. G Suite has a strong following in education with over 70 million users by 2017. Google G Suite is entirely cloud computing. But what happens when your internet goes out? This could cause major stress if you're unprepared. You'll need to download or email physical copies of your documents for times you won't be connected to the internet. Microsoft Office is available for both cloud computing use as well as remote computing use. Which to use? Let's look at it from the perspective of individual components. Choose Google if you need light word processing features. Stick to Word if you're on a more advanced features level. Here's an interesting study to note. When Creative Strategies surveyed over 350 college students across the country, they discovered 12% used Google Docs to write papers alone, 80% used Microsoft Word instead, 78% used Google Docs to write papers in a group collaboratively, just 13% used Word for group work. So you may want to follow in the footsteps of today's millennials and use Word for your personal use and Docs for your teamwork. In the case of Microsoft Excel versus Google Sheets, it is important to consider the context you will be using it in. Because Google Sheet is limited in function and customization, this software is for students, freelancers, or smaller to mid-sized businesses with modest data requirements. The majority of companies and individuals will find its features sufficient because it does offer a lot of the same options as Excel, but just not all of them. If you're part of a company that does a lot of in-depth data analysis and number crunching, you should probably invest in Microsoft Excel. Excel was built to store and work with massive amounts of data. At the end of the day, what differentiates the two is how they handle data. If your business needs some serious calculations with a lot of data, then Excel is a must-have. If not, you can always use Google Sheets, since it's free, and switch to Excel if you ever need better computational power. PowerPoint has been the worldwide leading presentation software for over 30 years now. Compared to PowerPoint, Google Slides was introduced only a few years ago. Both software programs are widely used and almost equally popular among users across the globe. At first, it may seem that Google Slides and PowerPoint are complete rivals. However, these two tools for presentations address the needs of different audiences. Google Slides is part of Google Docs as is completely free to use.
whereas PowerPoint is a part of Microsoft Office package. PowerPoint also offers a free online version of the software named PowerPoint Online. However, it lacks many of the advancements included in the desktop-based original product. The mobile version of PowerPoint for Android is free. Both software programs offer unique advantages over the other. Google Slides is user-friendly, multifunctional, and allow easy collaboration with your team members. PowerPoint, on the other hand, is an advanced product with many years of development behind its back, and it naturally offers more functions for the end user, but it's limited when it comes to co-working. At the end of the day, you'll mix and match apps from both Google Suite and Microsoft Office, and the winner is based on your own priorities and demands as their formats are interchangeable. Will 2020 be the year of the Linux desktop? The Linux App Summit was held last week in Barcelona, Spain, and its goal was to accelerate the growth of the Linux application ecosystem by bringing together everyone involved in creating a great Linux application user experience. The Linux App Summit was to help create a broader Linux application ecosystem that developers can all benefit from. The conference theme was the intersection of user experience, software development, and hardware distribution. GNOME, KDE, and other Linux developers came together to work on making incremental process on the Linux desktop. Nextcloud founder Frank Kolitschek challenged Linux developers to start working together to make life easier for would-be Linux application developers. If it does, he thinks Linux can be a significant desktop player. He had another bigger idea: reclaim the title of the Year of the Linux Desktop as a real plan. He reminded his audience in the 90s, when the free software open source movement really got traction, no one thought Linux could take over the server, but it did. So why didn't the Linux desktop as well? There was all the business reasons Microsoft dominated the market, but the Linux desktop also suffered from many self-inflicted wounds. Unfortunately, Linux desktop developers are still indulging in the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Kolitschek thinks that there's still a need for a free desktop, but that desktop must be more welcoming to third-party independent software vendors. Compared to any other end-user operating system, Linux has only a handful of applications. He suggests there's a need for a central developer portal. This is where developers can find the documentation, tutorials, software development kits, and examples they need to get up to speed and build applications. Next, they need stable application programming interfaces, that is APIs. You can actually run 20-year-old Windows applications still on the modern Windows. That's crazy, but you can. With Linux, you're always needing to recompile links to the newest libraries. The majority of the Linux desktop developers at the conference agreed that they need to unite their fragments into a whole and that every effort should be made to make life easier for developers to port their applications to Linux. After all, it's clear that not everyone is happy about having to move from Windows 7 to Windows 10, and Microsoft itself is intending on replacing the traditional Windows desktop with Windows as a service. The time for a mass market Linux desktop may yet come. The conference attendees overlooked the fact that there are hundreds of Linux distributions, which results in no real mass for any one or two distros. Application developers are not going to spend their time interfacing with each and every developer. You can have 300 people singing in harmony, or 300 people all singing at the same time their rendition of the same song. For Linux to succeed as a desktop operating system, it needs to coalesce into a handful of Linux distros that are well supported by everyday applications. The argument advanced by the Linux community is the added implementation of Wine. Wine, which was originally an acronym for Wine is not an emulator, is a compatibility layer capable of running Windows applications on several POSIX-compliant operating systems such as Linux, macOS, and BSD. For Linux to succeed as a desktop, Wine should be integrated with the Linux distro, but it's not. People do not select an operating system and ask what applications are available. They identify the applications needed and select the appropriate operating system that will support the application. Will 2020 be year the Linux desktop? I'm holding my breath. And from Marty Winston, using the wrong approach to clear snow on your driveway can mean nasty repair costs.
I need to interrupt myself. Before I dig deeply into your driveway snowfall, I want to touch on something else that I'm sure you'll want to know. If your car has LED headlights or LED taillights or turn signals, those LED lights may not get warm enough to melt off stubborn layers of ice or snow. So, if your car spends any time at all in places where before you can get on your way you need to take a brush or scraper to the windows, don't stop with just clearing the windows. Scrape those light lenses clean too. Let me make one more point about that. When the road crews address the snow on the streets, they leave behind slush and water. The tires on all the cars ahead of you are spinning that up and into the air as a wake spray, which is reducing visibility. If your headlights are covered, your ability to see what's ahead of you is handicapped. If your taillights are covered, you might be close to invisible to the cars behind you. I remember decades ago being on a film shoot that involved a race car track and a camera in a helicopter, and it was all happening, well, not terribly far from a small airfield. I asked the pilot how, in that circumstance, it was possible to avoid accidents. He told me that the first rule of flying in any airspace is to see and be seen. That stuck with me, as I hope it will stick with you. Brush and scrape those lights until they're clear, without exception if your car uses LED lights, but it's also a really good idea for everybody else. Now, let's deal with getting the car in and out of your driveway. How do you clear yours? How do others clear theirs? By the way, there's a checklist I'd like you to keep in mind. It's not complicated. Here goes. What kind of driveway do you have? Concrete, asphalt, gravel, mud, or something else? What kind of car or truck do you drive? Is it a low rider, a high step, two-wheel drive, all-wheel drive, or again, something else? What about your tires? All season or snow tires? Studded, chained, slicks, something so old it's almost treadless? Or brand new and well-treaded? Or are they narrow or wide? Are they compact car size or family sedan size or SUV pickup truck size or what? And also related, believe it or not, do you have pets who will be spending any time at all walking in those places you're clearing? Now, this is something I realized when I was dealing with a home's energy cost improvements, and I think the same thing applies to driveways. My first principle, your first principle, should be to stop losses. Hiring somebody with a plow to keep a gravel driveway clear is likely to lead to needing to buy replacement gravel in the spring. Using a snow thrower on a gravel driveway can send that gravel shooting off at high speeds and very easily cause damage or injuries. And again, you may have to replace a lot of the gravel in the spring. Let me add, there are some more expensive snow throwers that won't do that, and I'll get to them in a minute. For concrete or asphalt drives, your biggest vulnerability, the biggest loss you're going to face, could be through demolition. Here's how that happens. If you have uneven levels, cracks, or ridges, or major holes, a plow blade can pry them open. So could melting snow getting into those cracks and expanding when it refreezes. There are some cold weather patch products that can smooth them out for now, but you'll really want to be able to do something more permanent when the weather gets warmer. Now, absolutely do place reflective markers on the drive, no matter who clears the snow or who you do or don't expect in your driveway. Use approximately, roughly twice as many as you think you need, and keep some spares on hand. I like to use a cordless drill with an extra length bit to make the hole in the ground where I plant those sticks and then thump them a few times to drive them in deeper. If you have rocks or anything else that's bordering your drive, place your markers inside them, so keeping between the markers will mean keeping off the rocks. Okay, let's get into your choices for getting rid of the snow. Now, short of moving to a climate that never sees snow, let's consider what options are out there. Shovels, snow throwers, plows, snow melt products, and heat. Snow shovels are relatively inexpensive, and they're effective for most people most of the time, but not everyone. Even for the best and fittest among us, shoveling snow can lead to painful muscles, injuries, and in some cases, this is for real, heart attacks. For any one shovel, the range of weight of one shovelful can vary all over the place, because time and temperature and circumstances can change the density of the snow you're clearing. Push-style shovels usually involve less lifting, but may not. They certainly don't when the snow mound is deeper than the height of the shovel. A shovel may be appropriate for your front stoop and front steps, but for anything but a stubby driveway, it's a lot of work. Okay, well, the snow throwers are an interesting category, but there are some gotchas there. They have two major classes: the less expensive single-stage thrower that paddles the snow directly up from the ground and out the top chute, or the more expensive two-stage throwers that use one action to get the snow off the ground and a separate simultaneous action to eject it. Within each of these classes, and really across the span of snow throwers, there are differences in how they're powered by extension cord or battery or a gas engine. There are differences in how wide a path they clear in each pass, and a few other things. You want their front maw to ideally be taller than the deepest snow you'll get. And it's very difficult to isolate a model that's good for gravel drives. That requires something that can raise its lower lip by about 3/4 of an inch, so it just moves snow, not the gravel. That does leave that 3/4 of an inch of snow on the ground, but your car won't have any problem with that, will it? A snow plow blade on a garden tractor, if you have one, brings up a challenge that's also in play if you have a bigger plow blade on your own truck or if you hire a plow to clear your drive. And you may not think this is for real, but I've seen it. Plowing can fail if the snow load gets too heavy and the ground is too slippery and the truck or tractor just can't get enough traction. It will look like the plow blade is anchored and the body of the tractor or truck is wig-wagging like one of those boingy spring doorstops the kids like to play with. It's funny to watch, but the plow operator will not at that moment have much of a sense of humor. For that matter, neither will you next spring if that ends up rutting your yard. And again, a plow is not a great approach for gravel drives. Now, let's deal with a part of you that loves tech and has always wanted to have a drive where the snow never accumulates. It's possible, but it will cost you. There are electrically heated pads you can put down on your walks or driveway. And make no mistake, those can get your electric meter spinning at uncomfortably high speeds. You can go through the expense of piping your driveway for a recirculating heater running a special fluid. That's expensive to do, and it's likely to see a need for repairs in just a few years. By the way, that recirculating heater will also put a bump onto your utility bills. So, what if instead of trying to bring your driveway's temperature above snow's melting point, you were to instead chemically alter the snow to lower its freezing point? That's pretty much what happens when road crews spray beet juice on highways, but I prefer granules. I think the snowmelt category is one where I've been taking too much for too granted for too long, thinking that they're all pretty much the same and all work pretty much the same. I'd learned otherwise. Here are some of the ways they're different. How low the temperature gets before they lose their effectiveness. How much they create corrosion in inconvenient places, like the underside of your car or the underside of your snowblower. How much they kill lawns or plantings next to the pavement as they flow off with the melted snow. how much they burn your pet's paws, how much they can damage your carpets and floors if you or your pets track them back inside. Some rock salts, for example, stop working if the temperature drops below 24 to 25 degrees Fahrenheit. Some rock salt blends, they're good to plus 5 degrees, some alternatives to minus 5 degrees. Some products incorporate traction agents, but most don't. There are a lot of variations. If you ask others, ignore the people who are dismissive and just wave their hands and say something that begins with, "I just use," and then tell you what they use. It's the kind of answer that says they never did any homework. If you ask at a hardware or home store, be aware that they're more likely to recommend whatever they sell that comes closest and probably aren't as savvy about anything they don't sell. I recommend that you do your own first round of homework online, and even there. Remember that comparison charts are seldom objective and that negative customer reviews often come from competitors, even where the reviewer is verified as a buyer. Whatever snowmelt product you may choose, the colder it gets, the slower it will work, but don't be impatient. In fact, if the weather forecast says snow is coming, treat your drive before it arrives, even the night before. That tends to be an effective way to reduce the impact of the coming snowfall. Of course, for me, I cheat. I work at home, and both of our cars are Subaru all-wheel drive models. Next time, our show runs the night before Thanksgiving. And life, especially tech, gives us a lot to be thankful for. In balance, of course, it gives us a lot for which we'd love to be able to say, "No thanks." Thanks and no thanks. That's my theme, served with spice and sauce and a small dab of cream.
Thank you, Marty. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, November the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center in Ewing has a presentation on Windows 10 features that you may not be aware of. Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that's ACGNJ, meets Friday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium at the Harry J. Shore Hall. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.